The Leonard Lopate Show really needs your help. We are conducting an anonymous 5-minute survey to learn a bit about you and the podcast that you love. So visit wmyc.podcastingsurvey.com to find it, or click on the link in our show notes or on our show page. We'd really appreciate your help. Knowing more about you helps us put together more of the shows that you enjoy. Again, that's wnyc.podcastingsurvey.com. Thank you from all of us at the Leonard Lopate Show. Jeremiah Tower has been one of the most influential yet controversial figures in the history of American gastronomy. In addition to turning the food world on its head with California cuisine and an emphasis on local ingredients, the introduction of open kitchens, and having the bar serve as the heart of the restaurant rather than a waiting room. Lydia Tenaya tells his story, the story of his remarkable life, in her film called Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent. It opens tomorrow at the Sunshine Cinema. And joining us now, live from WNYC's Green Space, are Lydia Tenaya, chef, author, and television personality Anthony Bourdain, and Jeremiah Tower himself. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And Anthony, should I have added executive producer and publisher to your list?
Yeah, well, I do those things, yes.
Because Jeremiah's book, now I only have an early release of it, called Start the Fire, How I Began a Food Revolution in America. It's just been published by Echo under your imprint?
Yes.
Are you publishing other food
privilege.
Books?
Not just food books. People with strong and unique voices from, you know, any genre.
Jeremiah, is this a brand new book, or is this a revised version of your famous earlier book?
It's a revised version of California Dish, but it's got about, you know, 40% new material, new introduction, and a new take. And this one's better prose. I had a long time to edit it.
Well, I had a sense that you had good prose from the start.
Why, thank you.
That's part of your upbringing, the story that is told in this film.
Right.
Anthony, you say in the film that you think it's important people know the names of the people who changed the world. Is that why you signed on as executive director, producer of this one?
Well, I brought the project in. I read, I'd of course, as a working cook and chef for many years, I'd heard the name Jeremiah Tower spoken in admiring terms by various chefs I met. But it really wasn't until I read his memoir that I became really interested in, well, I was angry. I felt a sense of historical injustice that needed to be corrected. And I wanted it. I was intrigued and fascinated that so many of the things I take it for granted as being just sort of part of the language of American cooking that I'd been doing, it in fact come from Jeremiah, and I had no idea. And the extent to which he'd been written out of history angered me, and I brought the project to Lydia, my creative, longtime creative partner at 0.0, whose company makes Parts Unknown, and to CNN, and we started to put together this fascinating story about an incredible time and an incredible artist.
How much did you know about Jeremiah when you started, Lydia?
I had heard his name once, actually, and it was a long time ago. It was in a conversation with Ruth Reichel, who was actually in the film, and she had mentioned him and her time in Berkeley. But I hadn't really known much about him, you know, until Tony read the memoir, and then he gave it to me, and then I read it. And, you know, it was fascinating to read about such a character who had, you know, such an incredible impact on the culinary landscape, yet I didn't even know his name, and I've been working in food television for a long, long time.
You think this is a generational thing?
Yeah,
because,
I mean,
I've always known about Jeremiah Tower because I read, unfortunately, I didn't eat at Chez Panisse until after you'd left,
right.
But I'd heard about you, and then, of course, Stars, your famous mm-hmm. restaurant in San Francisco.
Right.
I don't want to. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but to some extent,
he is.
I am a conspiracy theorist. To some extent, year after year, largely because Jeremiah wasn't around, he was written out of history knowingly by people who knew better what had happened, who was responsible, what the question of true authorship really was, and I think he became an inconvenient man. And so it's not just generational. His name was kept alive by professional chefs, but he was not a name on everyone's lips in the increasingly foodie universe, and he deserved to be.
In the film, I was struck by the sheer audacity of chutzpah that you displayed. For instance, applying for a chef position at Chez Panisse, even though you'd had no experience other than hosting dinner parties for friends, and later selecting a dirty, rundown area as the site of your rather expensive restaurant in San Francisco Stars. Was part of it just going against the norm?
Well, it helps to have, you know, had very little money at the time. So I chose an area that, for two reasons. One, nobody else wanted it. And two, because it was next to the ballet, symphony, opera, the museum, the politicians, the courts, the lawyers. And I thought, you know, I was quite aware that if we opened there, we could get an audience before 7 o'clock and after 10 o'clock.
But didn't people warn you about the alley that they had to walk down to get into the restaurant?
Oh, when I took, you know, people like Ruth Rigel, but James Beard standing in the ruin that was this site, this old Italian restaurant, with rats running across his feet, and he was swiping them with his cane. He said, Jeremiah, this is a disaster. I went, I didn't see any disaster. All I saw was, you know, the finished product, looking at that space.
Well, obviously, the restaurant was a success, so people got past the disaster. Where does the title come from, Lydia? The Last Magnificent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a quote in the book. Actually, there was an article written by this well-known journalist, James Villas, and he had written this piece on Lucius Beebe, who was one of Jeremiah's, you know, heroes, I guess. Right. He was a bon vivant, a man who sort of single-handedly created the idea of cafe society. So there was a quote from Beebe, you know, talking about wanting to be sort of this man about town and, you know, on the avenues and sort of hobnobbing with the social elite and et cetera. And he's described as the last magnificent. When I heard that, I thought, you know, that seemed to be a fitting title for the
film. Kicked out of Harvard, was it Harvard or Yale, for showing up stone drunk every morning in a top hat?
Yeah.
Is that what you aspire to, Jeremy?
No, well, I lost my top hat a long time ago. But, and I never had a cane. But, you know, there was a phrase that he said that, because he was very, very fancy, he had a private railroad car, and he was very rich and all that sort of thing. So, but he said, you know, a day is not bad if it ends with, you know, someplace with a hot bird and a cold bottle. So I took that as roast chicken and butter maraîcher. He got my vote.
And drinking champagne was a major part.
Well, that's just the beginning. Oh. I mean, you know, that's how you start the day.
Based on your description of your childhood, clearly your first major accomplishment was just surviving. Looking back, are you surprised that you did?
Well, first of all, if I'd known what it was to be a chef, I would have run like hell down Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley.
Oh, I was thinking more about, for example, when the film opens with a reenactment of a scene from your childhood where you spent an entire day on the beach in Australia and your parents never noticed that you were gone. That's when you say you realize you better learn to care for yourself. And then there's that story where your parents were, you join your parents in a dining room and they ask you, what are you doing here?
Well, of course, I mean, I was enjoying that huge hotel. It was in London in the 50s. There was such a great pea soup fog outside. There was nobody around. So I was used to eating in this vast dining room with, you know, all the waiters around my table, slicing smoked salmon, spooning out caviar alone. You know, I thought it was great theater. Mm-hmm. But I've been listening to Tony, and I was the way it happened and the way it's been described, excuse me, would now be seen as child abuse. But actually at the time, it seemed like a lot of fun to me. Even so, I'm sure I sort of put aside all the negative feelings and brought them out to become a chef.
Well, your parents were very wealthy, and this gave you access to all these things, but did you start thinking about cooking when you were invited into the kitchens of some of these great hotels?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, I didn't want to be in those kitchens. You know, I wanted to be on the other side. I wanted to be out in the dining room being served. I became a chef by accident. So, I mean, I was on my way to Hawaii to do underwater architecture, and I ran out of money in San Francisco. And
you trained as an architect.
Yes, but I was a lousy architect, so I couldn't get a job.
You could have
certainly nobody.
You could have worked for the Alfred Portale.
Oh,
yeah. Sorry, that's an in joke.
That's an in joke, by the way.
Alfred Portale is famous for serving food that
vertical food. Yeah. Which I love Alfred, but I hated vertical food because, I mean...
He doesn't do it anymore.
It ends up in your neighbor's lap if you're, you know, and that's when you're lucky.
You were going to Hawaii, I'm sorry.
Sorry, I ran out of money, and my roommate at college, who's in the interview, is in the film, said, he and his wife, who was a great cook, said, you should answer that ad. Here's an ad in the newspaper, a little place in Berkeley called Chez Panisse is looking for an executive chef who is familiar with the philosophy, if there was one, with Elizabeth David and Fernand Poin. And I thought, Elizabeth David hated Fernand Poin. What are they talking about? I thought, but maybe they don't know that, so maybe I've got an in, you know. So I went over and fixed the soup and got a job, which shows you how desperate I was and how desperate they were.
And proceeded to change the world.
I'm speaking with Jeremiah Tower, who's the subject of a new film called Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent, that will open tomorrow at the Sunshine Cinema down in on Houston Street. Also with us are Lydia Tenaya, who made the film, and Anthony Bourdain, who appears in it and who also was the executive producer of it, and probably the reason the film got made in the first place.
I hope so.
So you get a job at Chez Panisse, which is already a pretty popular restaurant, wasn't it?
No, what? It was pretty much unknown. It was only
did
a year
they know
old.
That you were not trained at all?
I said they were desperate.
Anthony, you're a graduate of Culinary Institute of America, a veteran of numerous professional kitchens. Are you surprised that he was able to do what he did, considering his background?
No, because particularly in those times, cooking was done by misfits, outcasts, losers, dreamers, crackpots, romantics.
Like you.
The refuse. Yeah. But I was able, I too sort of stumbled into the restaurant business. I started as a dishwasher. Unlike Jeremiah, I was not a creative genius or an innovator, and I banged around in the business in a very workmanlike way for a lot of years. But I
you
think
did
this
well
was,
enough. You developed well, a it, reputation.
You know my name because of books, not because of my cooking career. But I think, you know, it was a magical time. It was a miraculous a confluence of forces. It was an environment that allowed this extraordinary man who'd grown up reading these menus and experiencing this food with a and cooking these dishes in his dorm room at Harvard. To do amazing things, which is what he did. He started cooking not just food, but writing menus, extraordinary menus that really changed the whole landscape.
So let's talk about those menus. Well, first of all, don't chefs usually start off with ingredients? You were starting off with menus.
No, ingredients are the beginning and middle and end of it all. I mean, in the restaurant. But I was inspired by, in those days, it sounds absolutely ludicrous now, but there were hardly any good ingredients around when we first started. We had to go look for them. I mean, somebody banged on the back door of the kitchen one evening and said, I have some mushrooms from the Berkeley Hills. And everyone, you know, other people said, well, no, you can't use those. They could be poisonous. And I said to him, have you eaten any of these? He said, of course, they're delicious. I said, fine, bring them in. Now bring in whatever mushrooms you find. There was a boat boy who you were allowed, when you came back on the trawling boats, whatever fish they caught, they could keep. So he knocked on the door one evening, and there was a beautiful big salmon in rigor mortis still. And cut a long story short, he ended up opening the biggest fish company in the Bay Area, you know, and supplied all the restaurants, including Stars. So the word went out, this guy will, you know, buy anything. Someone brought a moray eel, not a moray, a conger eel to the back door, and I said, fantastic, tomorrow we serve bouillabaisse.
Now, this is before New York restaurants started going to the Union Square Market and finding their ingredients.
This is before any farmers markets. Well, there was a San Francisco farmers market, mostly Asian.
So Chez Panisse had begun as a kind of a tribute to French bistro, and you decided to start using local ingredients and then also incorporating California wines. Your background would suggest that you would have been a wine snob and only insisted on French wines.
Well, that was true, but I couldn't tell the public that, for heaven's sakes. You know, we were in California. No, what happened was, in 1970, I was cooking festival menus around France, for all the regions of France. We ran out of the regions, so finally there was only one left, which was Corsica. I mean, I didn't even know where Corsica was, let alone, you know, what the food was. So that was the first really terrible meal that I cooked. And so the next day I thought, I can't do this again. That was no fun, you know, serving something I didn't like to 100 people. So I thought, I just had the moment, why am I beating myself to death over this, trying to find, you know, stockfish in Oakland? So I said, okay, I just had that moment. Wait a minute, why not just... we've got these wonderful things now by 76. The prawns from Monterey Bay, the Petrolli sole. I had some geese that I was raising in Sonoma, you know, to make cassoulet. So I just wrote the California Regional Dinner in 1976. And all in English, all California wines, and naming the sources for the first time.
And the impact was almost immediate? Everybody started imitating.
Everybody freaked out. It was an absolutely revolutionary act to proudly attribute menu items and ingredients specifically to uniquely American locations and sources. Huge, and paired with American wines. Not only did diners like it, but it was national news in the food press, and literally now every menu's like that almost. But that then, back then, it was a bold and hugely influential statement.
We have a clip from the film. Should we watch it?
Oh, yeah, let's.
Most people would not know who Jeremiah Tower is. And sadly, he certainly is considered, in my book anyway, a father of the American cuisine.
Due in the 80s and early 90s, Jeremiah Tower was one of the major names in this country. He was on the front of magazines. He was known all over Europe.
The very first thing I heard about after I heard about Chez Panisse was Jeremiah Tower. He was the darling, the glamour puss, the sexy guy, the smart guy, and the innovative chef that became something that was what everyone wanted to know about.
In the 70s, Alice Waters opens Chez Panisse. You cannot begin to understand the impact on the food landscape.
1972, Jeremiah Tower walks into Chez Panisse. Everyone, reluctantly or not, have to agree that he put the place on the map. Jeremiah Tower's menus made Chez Panisse the place that everybody wanted to go. A complete reevaluation of not just American food and ingredients, but food.
That was a little clip from the film. Now, you probably recognize some of those voices: Martha Stewart, Mario Batali, Ruth Reichel, and Anthony Bourdain, who is with us here, along with Lydia Tenaya, who is the director of a film called Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent, which opens tomorrow at the Sunshine Cinema. And we are fortunate to have the subject of the film here as well, Jeremiah Tower. And we will continue right after this. We're broadcasting live from WMIC's Green Space. And we are back with Jeremiah Tower, who is the subject of a new film called Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent, which opens tomorrow at the Sunshine Cinema. Also with us are Lydia Tenaya, who made the film, and Anthony Bourdain, who's the executive producer of it, and also somebody who obviously admires Jeremiah Tower a lot. And he has also put Jeremiah Tower's book, Start the Fire, How I Began a Food Revolution in America, out under his imprint. That is the Anthony Bourdain Books Under Echo.
Yes.
And is this book out already?
It is
yes.
Out.
Yes. Yes, it is out. Yes. Yep. Absolutely.
In bookstores, yes. Everywhere.
As we speak. Yeah.
Now, Lydia, how did you get that footage of the Chez Panisse kitchen? It's just fascinating stuff.
Yeah, no, it's funny because, you know, as we went into our deep archival research, there was sort of little that was coming up during that time frame that we could use and access. And years ago, I had worked on a project with Ruth Reichel about her time in Berkeley, and she had mentioned this film, Garlic is as Good as 10 Mothers, by Les Blank, famous documentary filmmaker. She said, you know, that she had participated in that film, and I had sort of dug around. This was a long time ago, and I had found this tiny little 10-second clip of Ruth, you know, back in the day, back in her Berkeley years. And so we started to look into that. Les has passed away. His son manages the estate. We talked to him. He said, listen, I can't license the film, the actual film footage to you, but we have all the outtakes from the film. Would you like to see that? And I mean, you know, it was just
that
one of those moments.
Better.
It was one of those happy accidents where, you know, he very wonderfully and accommodatingly transferred a good bulk of the outtakes from the film, and that's what we were able to use during that period.
And Jeremiah, were you aware that they were filming the kitchen at that time?
This was Les was around a couple of times. I think it was on the third birthday or something of Chez Panisse. But we had to ask him to stop filming because somebody, for the first time anyone had ever seen it, introduced a half a pound of cocaine on top of the freezer in the back of the kitchen. So that film sort of came to an end. But this was later.
I'd be interested in seeing those outtakes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, now I think somebody burned them.
And then you left Chez Panisse and opened Stars, which became a big success. And there's a lot of footage from Stars as well because it became a celebrity hangout. Was that when the phrase celebrity chef was kind of invented?
I don't know when that first appeared, but Anthony, you know that.
It wasn't even a concept then. It was an unimaginable thing.
Well, there were famous French chefs.
Yeah, but they were not mentioned in the same way as movie stars. They were esteemed. They were well known. They were looked up to. They were local heroes of a sort, but they were not celebrities. And this was something very, either of those things, very, very new to America. Jeremiah was the first chef who the customers wanted and demanded to see in the dining room. They needed to see him there.
So you came out of the kitchen. Right. It was an open kitchen.
Yes, it was an open kitchen.
And then you came out and you would go from table to table.
Right, right.
And now that seems, sometimes I would prefer the chef not to come to my table.
Well, you know, I mean, and you know, given the story of Manhattan and what you're saying, would you bring me my cocktail, please? Mm-hmm. You know, but, you know, there was a point in the 80s, late 80s, Time magazine said that I'd had more publicity than Meryl Streep. Rightly or wrongly, I'm not sure. But the point was, how could a cook get the same kind of amount of publicity as a movie star?
You know, however, for whatever reason, the fact is that as annoying as the celebrity chef phenomenon might be, that this thing that Jeremiah created or became caused a power shift. It made chefs interesting. It made chefs worth listening to. It gave them the power to suggest to their customers or to tell their customers, look, this is what I'm good at. This is the food that I love. You know, maybe you think you'd like a steak with, you know, potatoes on, but I feel I'm particularly good at this and I'd like you to try it. That shift in power, that assignment of the idea that the chef could be interesting and worth talking to and worth listening to really opened the door for so many other creative people.
Was there pressure on you to keep on coming up with new things?
Yes, but I also, that's what I love doing because that's what inspired me and what kept the restaurant going.
Because I had a friend who had a wonderfully successful restaurant and she would want to change things all the time, and then even a famous reviewer came in and said, why isn't whatever it is on the menu anymore? That's my favorite. I come here for that dish.
Right. Well, that's the
you're caught in
one.
That bind, aren't you?
Well, especially at Stars because the menu changed every day. So
whatever you found in the market.
Absolutely, absolutely. But the power of the chef at that time meant that I could also introduce things to the world. For instance, it said, I can't remember if it's true, but it said that Starz was the first to introduce champagne by the glass, probably in California, not the United States. But someone would come to me, and I loved the wines from Alsace, and they told me we can't sell a drop in the United States and California. So I tasted them and put them on the menu, and I put them up on the mirror. I put them at the top of the menu. I did a special card for the table. I said, these are my favorite wines. Well, there was a market. You know, within a week, they were selling cases of them. So the celebrity chef, that power actually could be put to wonderful things.
Do you think you'd still be there if there hadn't been an earthquake?
Oh, no, I would have had the sense to sell it long before. Actually, I sold it in 98 to a Chinese group, and then they ran it for 2 years and sold it. But you know, I had done restaurants for 35 years. That's like 70 years in other jobs. So,
and, especially if you're a perfectionist, and that's one of the things people claimed about you.
Right. There's a certain obsession about doing it well. I think we're, like Tony and Lydia, vaccinated with making sure that everything's done right.
And then you took off and went to Mexico?
Yes. Well, I went to New York for a little bit. I went to New York briefly, and 9/11 happened, so I left New York and went to New Orleans, and then Katrina happened, so I left New Orleans.
Earthquakes.
And then I ended up on Cozumel when I got the news about Katrina, and I realized, wow, I'm homeless and possessionless. I lost, you know, everything. I fortunately still had my checking account, but, you know, the rest was gone. So about 40 margaritas later, I thought, well, as long as I'm on a tropical island, go for it.
Now, we don't have the time to talk about what happened when you finally came back and worked at Tavern on the Green and the disaster that was. But would it have been possible for any great chef to have kept to the standards that you've established for yourself in a restaurant that has 700 seats?
No.
No.
But I learned that lesson.
You thought you might be able to do it?
Well, you know, no one ever said I didn't have a huge ego.
And he does.
It's okay for me to say it, Lydia, not you.
Well, Jeremiah, I know of any number of restaurant spaces in New York that probably have 60 or 70 seats. Would you consider?
They don't have tropical beaches.
So you have moved to Mexico for good now?
No. I mean, I might do a restaurant with Mario Batali on the Amalfi Coast. I might take up that offer in Phuket to do a bar on the beach. That sounds heavenly, actually.
And there, obviously, there's another movie in this, isn't there?
Magnificent Two, The Revenge.
Jeremiah Towers, Revenge.
The Revenge. I love that.
I think he is a Rolling Stone. I think he has been since, he was young. You know, his family traveled him everywhere, and I think he doesn't like to lay down too many roots.
I think this film is a lot of fun, not just for people who love food, but for people who are just interested in good stories about what happened in the world over the last 50 or 60 years. And my great thanks to all of you for being on our show, this live broadcast that we've been doing from the Green Space with Jeremiah Tower, Lydia Tenaglia, Anthony Bourdain. The film, Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent, opens tomorrow at the Sunshine Cinema.